Welcome, welcome. This is Urban Nature, a podcast from Istanbul 74. I'm Gabriel Koslovsky. I'm a Brazilian architect and curator. I work on questions pertaining urbanization from the perspective of political ecology. In Urban Nature, I talk to prominent thinkers who have been pushing the boundaries of how we understand the relationship between humans and the natural environment. Today, I'm delighted to host Tania Lee. Tania is a professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto. She's known for her studies concerning land, labor, capitalism, development, politics, and ingenuity, with a particular focus on Indonesia. Her work crosses multiple fields, like geography, planning, law, environmental studies, while bringing different actors together, from activists to policymakers, to make sense of transformations brought about by processes such as land reform, rural class formation, struggles over forests and their conservation, state-organized resettlement initiatives, and problems faced by people who are pushed off their land. Her books include the award-winning Land's End, Capitalist Relations on an Indigenous Frontier, Plantation Life, written with Pujo Samedi, The Will to Improve, Governmentality, Development, and the Practices of Politics, the edited volume Powers of Exclusion, and many more. Tania, thank you so much for accepting this invitation. I'm thrilled to have you here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Tania, I've known your work for quite a while, and when I started teaching, it was around the concept of territory, to which your writings about land were essential. I'm happy we're going to have this conversation today and to be able to tackle some points that or some questions that your work explores. And also, I'm aware that there are many directions we could take this conversation. I think there are three themes in your work or three interrelated themes that most profoundly cut across the majority of your production and of the concepts you engage with, which are land, labor, and politics. I will try to use these three themes as anchor points to structure the conversation, and from there, bring other topics, places, and subjects that you have carefully analyzed through the framework enabled by these three. I would like to start straight out with land, not only because you have advanced our understandings around questions of land to a point that has made profound contributions to many fields beyond anthropology, but also because land inevitably exists in the intersection between nature and culture, and sometimes it is taken for granted as a settled or inert concept. You showed us that the idea of land carries a huge historical baggage, and it's rather an active idea in continuous transformation that has defined much of what we call modernity. When you ask yourself, what is land, on a paper with that title, you examine the practices that make up land as a resource, or that transform something given, like a terrain, into something culturally constructed onto which we assign different types of values and that enable certain modes of relation. This is a transformation of making something concrete and material into a form of abstraction. Can you explain a bit how you see the concept of land, and why is it that, as you have suggested, what is land for a farmer is not the same thing as what is land for a tax collector?
Right. So in thinking about the question of what is land, I think I made the kind of classic anthropological move that we usually describe as making the familiar strange. And so as usual, I was guided by my fieldwork. And in the highlands of Sulawesi, where I've spent a lot of time with farmers, I noticed that the local language actually has no word for land. It has half a dozen more specific words that refer to different elements and translate as things like earth, soil, farm plot, second year fallow, old growth forest, and so on. So I also noted that when these came a point when my highland interlocutors started to treat land as a commodity, something new for them. And when they did that, they actually imported an English word for it via Indonesian. They used the word lokasi, which is a strange word, something like location. And it's very strange that it seemed to suggest the arrival of an entity that had not existed before, and also that had a new kind of affordance or new purpose. It could be converted into cash or exchanged with another lokasi somewhere else. It really was something new. So This got me thinking that, you know, rather than conceive of land as a thing or, you know, as something given or that we can assume, it's probably more useful to think of affordances. What do land or its cognate concepts, what do they do? What do they mean? What do they enable for different actors, you know, including tax collectors, you know, for whom land is an item in a ledger, a point of revenue, you know, things quite different from a Highlander, you know, thinking about where he can plant his crops.
And you bring, throughout your work, you bring attention to what you call inscription devices that include physical objects like the axe, the spades, the plow, natural and spiritual symbols like trees or ancestral graves, bureaucratic apparatuses in the form of title deeds and tax registers, and also cartographic techniques like maps, surveys, and satellite images. You argue that these devices don't simply build or record knowledge, but they are integral to assembly land as a resource. But they go further as to, quote unquote, to be used to seize land in the mind before it's seized on the ground, as you reference Nicholas Bloomley. So it's a practice that has been instrumental for a global process of land grab and land rush in the name of development that has been accelerated at least since 2008. So this is knowledge generated to classify land and make technical the labels of underutilized, marginal, idle, or frontier zones, so they can be converted to assets for market use, like as food or profit generation, while at the same time making visible their original inhabitants and the other types of roles these places have performed, like you have suggested when you mentioned the different words they use. When you talk about development, you use the term rendering technical. How can we relate this term to the practices of land privatization that tend to override the other more idiosyncratic ways of relating to the land?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think for me, the essence of this idea of rendering something technical is to render it in some way or attempt to render it non-political. Yeah. So a land classification system poses as a neutral device for inscribing information about land, let's say its slope, its quality, etc. But in doing so, it has actually performed a hugely political act of abstracting land from its many other meanings and affordances, foregrounding certain forms of knowledge and practice, and, you know, remaindering or rendering others invisible. So, you know, in this apparently technical operation of recording something or classifying something, a whole lot of political and cultural work has actually gone on. So, you know, concretely, when I started thinking about this, and in that paper that you reference, What is Land?, I was fascinated to see how different kinds of inscription device could produce different effects. So the World Bank, for example, in the report that I was examining, you know, in this report, it produced a series of graphs and diagrams showing what it called a yield gap that could be closed only if farmers or corporations would focus on growing the optimal crops and produce them efficiently. So here's a new, say it's an inscription device, you know, the idea not just of yield, but a yield gap, comparing actual versus optimal, what is on the land and what should be or could be in order to produce an optimal yield and a better revenue. So in that operation, hundreds of different crops and farming and herding practices appeared in the graph only as a deficit, as the cause of a gap, mm-hmm. not on their own terms. Then, even more astonishing, in this bank report, the report writers mapped yield gaps to different parts of the globe using, of all things, the color red to highlight hot zones of gappiness, you know, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, areas of the world where the yield gap, now established as a thing, was apparently huge and shocking and, you know, needed to be rectified right away. So, you know, these kinds of inscription devices, something simple like graphs and maps, are in fact doing a huge amount of work shaping our vision and our understanding of the world we live in. And so I think, you know, we need to be attentive to what they are, to how they work, to how they work upon us, and to all the things that they frame, and of course, like any framing device, all the things that they exclude. A lot of work going on with in and around these devices.
Exactly. And it's something that usually affects more the countries they label underdeveloped, right? And this brings me to the expression that you use, that are called lens end, that you use to title one of your books, and describes a series of relations and processes that take place in geographies across the world. But if I'm not mistaken, there is especially a focus on these places considered underdeveloped. And lens end represents the changed use of lens, but also it represents the end of customary relations of land sharing, the end of primary forests that served as local people's land frontier, but also the means for which land is put to work. And you suggest a sense of bewilderment, of something coming to a dead end. So it's an expression with multiple possibilities of interpretation that can tackle different types of processes. I wonder, what are the losses that this end represents? And how are some of the ways these changes are set in motion?
So in my book, you know, Land's End, what I was describing was some indigenous highlanders in a relatively remote area of Indonesia who, as you mentioned, you know, were living on a forest frontier. So unlike farmers in Java, for example, for whom landlessness has been a fact of life for almost two centuries. I mean, there's reports of extensive landlessness in Java, you know, going back to the 1820s. So, you know, for them, the condition of being landless wouldn't have been something very shocking. But for indigenous highlanders, it was something completely new. They had no previous experience of this. In fact, their own name for themselves was farming people. You know, you ask them who they are, they'd say Tope Jo'ol, you know, we're people of the farms. And so to be a farm person without a farm made no sense to them at all. It meant not only a crisis of livelihood, but a crisis of identity and personhood. You know, a person without a farm cannot support themselves and their children, you know, must rely on the charity of others. This was a deeply demoralizing and for them, deeply shameful situation. So, you know, there's an ethnographic specificity to this. You know, as many parts of the global south, as I mentioned, you know, landlessness has long been a fact of life and wouldn't have been so shocking. But on a land frontier, a forest frontier, it is a shocking thing. Yeah. The surprise, you know, in the case that I studied, what concerns your second question of how this change was set in motion. You know, we're used to stories of land grabbing in which a big bad corporation arrives on the scene, you know, evicts the farmers or indigenous people and seizes their land. This is a very familiar story. But in this case, the highlanders that I was, whose experience I was following, had initiated the change themselves, when they decided to plant a perennial crop, in this case, cacao. And in so doing, you know, it broke the chain in which land previously circulated among kin who used it in a loose rotation. That was the basis of their customary land system. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was something that I had to try to explain, not just why they did this, you know, why would a group of indigenous highlanders effectively enclose their own shared land and assert individual property rights to it? Not only why did they do this, but also how did they do this? How did they go about enclosing their own land excluding kin and neighbors plot by plot, and eventually turning their land into a commodity that could be freely bought and sold. So it's not a story that fits very easily, you know, in a series with other analyses of Indigenous people, you know, up against capital, understood as a force, often an embodied force, like, you know, a corporation with a bulldozer kind of arriving from the outside. But in fact, I don't think it's uncommon, right? I think that in many, under many conditions, people do in fact enclose and commodify their own land. And although it's not a popular story, you know, it's part of the drama, and it's something that we actually need to attend to, you know, under what conditions does this happen? Why does it happen? And what are the consequences and so on? So yeah, losses, but also the ways in which, you know, the causes of all of this, you know, was something that I tried to address in my account.
But when you realized that this was a movement that was happening from inside out, let's say, that there are a process almost self-inflicted, but they're at the same time, they're responding to something, to a certain aspiration of a type of life that is, that comes from outside as well, right? So there is a sort of, there are a couple forces that for that make them change, decide to change their crops or decide to change something that used to be collective to something that's now is privatized, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that this question of, you know, what James Ferguson calls it, like expectations of modernity or, you know, desire, you know, it's a real feature of the modern world, and no one is immune to it. You know, these highlanders, you know, look down at people living on the coast adjacent to their highland villages, and they ask themselves, you know, how come their children have shoes and go to school, whereas our children, you know, are going to grow up another generation that's illiterate and cannot speak Indonesian? And they decided they wanted to change that, right? This desire to belong, the desire for education, for one's children to have the opportunities that other children have, you know, I don't think there's any stopping that. You know, that's something that's extremely widespread, and Indigenous communities are certainly not immune to it. So I don't think of this desire as something that's either, you know, unilaterally imposed or some sort of a, you know, conspiracy. So again, you know, talking to Indonesian colleagues about this, they're often quick to judge, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, people have become too consumer oriented. But, you know, if it was me, I'd want my kids to go to school. I'd like to have a battery for my flashlight, you know, if I woke up in the night. And, you know, there are material things that people want and need. And so, and there are consequences to that, right? So I think that's the sort of the larger framing that we have to keep in mind when we acknowledge, when we think about, you know, what's coming from the inside and what's coming from the outside. You know, I think, you know, Foucault said this, right? Desires always have histories. They come from somewhere. You know, they, you know, not none of us are formed with desires, but we all acquire them. And, you know, Indigenous Highlanders acquire them too. And that's part of what we have to reckon with and make sense of.
Yes. And in this topic about the commodification of land, and sometimes you mention acts of resistance or resistance to the types of practices of land enclosure, speculation, marketization. You say that land is different from other traded things because it stays in place. It is excludable, it can be partitioned, but it cannot be removed. It resists full commodification. And then you even mentioned like water, its life-giving qualities make its complete exclusion unacceptable. And you remind us of Karl Polanyi's assertion that to treat land and labor only as commodities would be, and here I quote him, to allow the market mechanism to be the sole director of the fate of human beings and natural environment, resulting in the demolition of society. To which extent you think land and labor can act as forces not to corroborate with, but to dispute some of the hegemonic mechanisms of capital generation, or to preserve other forms of living in the world.
Right. So that's a challenging question. You know, I mean, on the one hand, the kind of the presence of land, and I'm thinking again ethnographically, which is often the way I bring myself to kind of work things through theoretically. But, you know, Highlanders who had lost control over their land told me they would walk past a plot, you know, with these beautiful cocoa trees, which they had sold to their cousin or their neighbor, and kind of, you know, regret that they had sold this thing, you know, in some moment of financial crisis or emergency. But they did recognize that they had made that transaction, and that they were responsible for it. So even though the land was still there, sort of staring at them, there was a level at which its commodification was something they actually accepted. So I think that on this point, we have to you know, push back a little bit on Polanyi. And this became for me one of the important ethnographic puzzles that I had to solve. You know, he argued, as you just quoted, or he anticipated, that people would resist the commodification of land, but in fact, these Highlanders embraced it. Mm-hmm. What I found that they actually resisted was the full and complete commodification of labor. Mm-hmm. It made complete sense to them that a person could do what he or she wanted with the soil, so long as they put their own effort into it. So, you know, Indonesia's indigenous people, actually, like people throughout Southeast Asia, and I think in other parts of the world as well, you know, have what John Locke would readily recognize as a kind of labor theory of property, right? Their indigenous understanding is that what you work for belongs to you. Mm-hmm. So that means that, you know, for them, claiming private property in land isn't actually a big leap. You know, it's only just one step further from claiming private property in the crops that you grew. With labor, it's a bit different, because working for another person means that your work, that what you work for now, belongs to them and not to you. Mm-hmm. And that idea sat very badly with them. They thought it was a kind of an affront on dignity and personhood. So I think what this means kind of theoretically is that, you know, we can take Polanyi, just like we take other theorists, you know, Marx, Foucault, and others, you know, we can take them into the field with us, but we, at some level, we need to carry them lightly and, you know, not impose their analysis too stridently in a way that kind of interferes with our capacity to make sense of what people are doing and saying and how they're acting. So, you know, in this case, you know, Polanyi's theories became tools to think with. They suggested to me not how the world is, but questions to ask. How did people understand the commodification of land? Mm-hmm. Did they, in fact, regard it as the great transformation that changes everything, as Polanyi suggested? Or did they take it in their stride? You know, and if so, how? Like, what made it make sense to them? And how about labor? Was it the same? Was it different? You know, I found that Highlanders had a long tradition of working for each other occasionally for wages in cash or kind. So at that level, the commodification of labor was not something that was new to them. But what was new, radically new, was to be a landless person and therefore forced to work for another person or beg them to give you. And that was something they found completely appalling. So I think, you know, we can learn from Polanyi, but we shouldn't, he has the questions, but not necessarily the answers.
Absolutely. When we talk about land, we've mentioned that there's always a decision there, at least in this context in Indonesia or in other farming contexts, there is the decision of change crops and how that affects the livelihood of these populations. But I would like to grow in scale and talk about farming at a different scale, at the scale of your research on palm oil plantations. And, mm-hmm. and You've mentioned that a plantation is like a machine, and a machine that assembles land, labor, and capital in huge quantities to produce monocrops for a world market. It is intrinsically colonial, based on the assumption that the people on the spot are incapable of efficient production. I think a little bit of what you touched before with the World Bank and this kind of world land grabbing process at a world scale. But it's also a moment where political economy and political ecology converge to build accumulation regimes, produce new subjects, and make new worlds. If for political economy, you're using Marx to examine the global circulation of capital, land appropriation, agrarian class formation, and labor regimes, for political technology, you're borrowing from Foucault and the discourses, institutions, architecture forms, and regulatory decisions for ordering territories and populations. And as you said, these are starting points, things that we bring in our pockets to the field in order to validate questions or at least formulate some of these questions. But so can you elaborate on how political economy and political technology intersect on the plantation as a machine?
Right. So, first of all, just a bit of context. Like, I don't see this as necessarily a different scale of analysis, but it's certainly a different form of production. So, you know, Indonesia has both these things going on. You know, on the one hand, smallholders involved in, increasingly capitalist relations of production among themselves. But it also has this form of the large scale plantation. And that's the format which is much more familiar to people working with literatures on land grabbing. Like, that is the picture of the corporation that arrives, you know, with bulldozers to seize hold of land and evict people. And that's exactly what's happening in the case of Indonesia, particularly around the crop oil palm, which is grown mainly on large-scale plantations. So to understand, you know, this form of life, like the plantation format of production and also a form of life, you know, obviously I need a different kind of theoretical machinery than or apparatus than was relevant to another study where corporations were largely absent. So, you know, thinking about what are the theories that we have that can help us? Like, on the one hand, as you mentioned, theories derived from political economy, questions of land and labor, capital and profit, you know, they are kind of indispensable tools in this analysis, as they were, in fact, also in the other one. How does capital actually take hold of land on this scale? Right, it's as we noted earlier. You can't just grab it. You first of all have to make it up. You know, you have to inscribe it. You have to have a land law and processes for allocating land concessions and systems for paying the people who decide between competing interests and decide which corporation will be granted the concession and so on. So there's a whole set of other operations necessary for capital to actually take hold of land and engage in production. And so, you know, these are, you know, the larger field that one could think of in terms of political technology, or, you know, the system of signs, relations, devices, arguments and rationales that one could think of as a political technology. So in the case of Indonesia's oil palm plantations, which I studied with my Indonesian colleague, Pujo Semedi, what we identified was that the rationale enabling this massive expansion of corporate plantation agriculture was the profoundly racialized colonial myth of the late native, you know, which had been studied by Malaysian historian Syed Hussein Alatas in a brilliant book called The Myth of the Lazy Native. And what Alatas explored for us was how deeply embedded this myth was not only in kind of colonial government, but in colonial era land regimes, which persist to the present. So Indonesian land law, formulated by the Dutch colonial power in 1870, basically rendered customary land rights invalid and gave the government the authority to issue corporate land concessions on a massive scale. This colonial era land law is still basically in place. You know, the 1960 land law passed after independence retains key clauses of the colonial law. And that's the legal regime, you could say the political technology, together with the rationale that enables plantation corporations to take control over land today. Like oil palm corporations in Indonesia currently control about a third of Indonesia's total farmland. It's vast. How do they do this? Basically by mobilizing the argument that the natives on the spot are lazy and incompetent, and so you need corporations to get the job done. So, you know, it's that set of devices, laws, practices, and processes that you have to examine in order to understand how the apparently simple logic of kind of land, labor, and capital actually comes together in the form of a plantation.
Yeah. So I think I would like to dive deeper into this aspect that you mentioned, this colonial aspect that, as you mentioned, it has a history, right? And it has a history not only in Indonesia, but worldwide. You see some phenomena related to this mode of operation carried by plantations that are, they seem to replicate a little bit of the things that you describe in Indonesia. Because I think, first of all, historically, we all know that capitalism was not born in the manufacturing floor, right? It was rather on the slave plantations in the Caribbean. And for some, this is also the birth of modernity and the industrial scale management of space and time and labor force. So when you and Pujo Semedi equate the plantations to icons of modernity, you mentioned that they disable old forms of life and construct in place new conditions of existence. And in contemporary times, the scale of corporate plantation is unprecedented, and it makes these places operate almost, as the two of you mentioned, like a self-enclosed world. And so I would like to discuss the combination of three big aspects that you've identified on the ways in which plantation operates. You've identified others, but I would like to focus on these three, like you mentioned, colonization, but also occupation and extraction. You mentioned that not unlike villagers in Palestine, villagers under plantation occupation are subject to a ban without a ban, an exclusion from normal citizenship, and here normal citizenship under quotes, that is not legally inscribed. That there is a form of colonization, a rule without consent, that ascribes differential value to people and the places they inhabit that can, in fact, injure them in various ways. In its essence, is a system of extraction. It may be extraction of natural elements, but it also may be an extraction of life's possibilities or of profit. So how are these worlds and lives that plantations create and maintain?
Yes. So, of course, you know, in our analysis, we are not suggesting that being occupied by a plantation corporation is the same as being occupied by a military force, right? So, I mean, to clarify, what we drew on from our readings about Israeli occupation in Palestine was a series of insights about how occupation works, you know, both socially and spatially. Mm-hmm. So a key insight from that work, is to explore how even a military occupation, or how in this case, the occupation of Palestine, is both socially and spatially striated. So what we came to understand is that different populations are occupied in different ways. Some are occupied directly, others indirectly. Still others are nominally not occupied at all, but still they encounter a wall or a checkpoint or someone interrupts their water supply and so on, right? So basically, you know, occupation, in fact, isn't an enclosed world. It's more like a sort of a spreading form that takes on different dimensions for differently situated populations and spread across a landscape. So taking this then to the plantation zone, what we realized is that the plantation corporations directly occupy only their concession land. Mm-hmm. So that, you could say that's the enclosed world part, right? It's the part within the concession in which the corporation, you know, rules and legally has the power to determine the conditions of life for its workers and for the plants and species and so on that are subject to it. But that's only part of the story, because these corporations have no formal responsibility for or even any direct relationship with the surrounding population who are classified as ordinary villagers. But in fact, nothing about the lives of these people is ordinary. The corporations have taken away all their farmland and left them stranded in tiny residual spaces with no land and no work. So, you know, they are also an occupied population, but they're occupied differently. Mm. And that's where we say, you know, they're subject to a kind of occupation which is not legally declared, or in Agamben's terms, you know, they're subject to a ban without a ban, a ban that legally does not exist, but in fact is in place. When we address the question that you pose here, you know, what is the form of life that a plantation actually sets in place? It's not limited to the area within its boundaries. It spills over into the entire apparatus of government, into the wider landscape, into the way that law works, politics works, and so on. So, that's the form of life, what we call, life under corporate occupation. It's definitely rule without consent. You know, the villagers have no say in this matter. And, rather in the way that Mbembe describes life under colonial occupation, you know, he says that it never occurred to the colonizers to ask the permission of their colonial subjects or to request their consent. Like, the whole idea of permission or consent is completely absurd in the question, in the case of a colonial occupation. Well, it turns out to be pretty absurd in the case of corporate occupation too. It is rule without consent, even though it is undeclared. So, you know, that's sort of where we took that idea. And we were really stimulated by trying to understand the kind of violence that's involved in corporate occupation. Because, again, as with other kinds of occupation, like the direct violence is often at the beginning, you know, when the occupier arrives and seizes hold of territory. That's when you might see the guns and the bulldozers and so on. But once the occupying force is installed, and in this case, once, let's say, 20,000 hectares of monocrop oil palm are installed, you could say that the occupier, you know, the presence is there, and it doesn't necessarily require guns and guards to maintain it, because what can the people do? You know, the occupying force has already taken hold.
And of time becomes a normal, a condition that they don't know how to exist without it.
They can't imagine any circumstances under which it would go away, or under which they could make it go away. And this is also common, you know, with people living under military occupation as well, right? That, you know, you may have skirmishes with the occupier, you know, a little arson here and theft there and a protest or a boycott and, you know, small actions to try to achieve small gains. but under no illusion that you can make the occupier go away.
And you've been vocal about questions of labor under mass plantations. You mentioned how in the farming of soy and wheat in Brazil, for example, hundreds of thousands of hectares are, quote unquote, labored only by three guys with their tractors. the types of work that contemporary societies value make the very concept of work deeply problematic. You've argued that the idea that one's worth and value and dignity and claim to resources, the idea that this will all be routed through paid labor at a period in which the horizon of that type of activity is receding, it's kind of insane. And you say that we must get away from this idea that work is the center of how you get your share, your human value, and how you are entitled to a decent life. So shifting a little bit from the plantation to a more broad questions about this contemporary situation, how could this decentering take place so we reassess the meaning of work in the 21st century?
So one of I think you're referring to a couple of things I've written, but one of them was a working paper that I wrote with an Indonesian, with a US-based anthropologist, James Ferguson. In the paper we called Beyond the Proper Job, Political Analysis After the Century of Laboring Man. And what we were trying to reflect on this paper is, you know, on the one hand, the kind of the stubbornness of the modernization narrative, the kind of transition narrative, which seems to suggest that, in the course of sort of structural transformation, people will move from farm to factory, from country to city, from informal work into the formal sector, like all of these kind of linear transitions which are expected to happen, are not happening now and are very unlikely to happen at any time in the future, right? So, and yet, you know, remarkably, this transition narrative is remains very stubborn. You know, you find it in writings by the World Bank on, you know, transitions into work and agrarian transitions and so on, you know, as if factory jobs will just appear in each and every country at the historical moment when a labor force emerges that, you know, that needs these jobs. Obviously, this is nonsense, but it's very stubborn in policy. And, you know, it's also very stubborn in society, right? I mean, there's a sense in which this idea of transitioning from the farm, you know, young people transitioning from the farm work, or let's say the informal sector work that their parents did, into, quote, the proper job, you know, salaried employment, white collar work, you know, is something that people in many parts of the world hold very dear. You know, they do want and aspire to proper jobs, if not for themselves, then for their children. So, you know, we're in a world in which this kind of desire is widespread, and in some places, this kind of mistaken expectation that that's the kind of linear trajectory. So sooner or later, these jobs will come. I think we tried to decenter work in the way that anthropologists normally do, by making it strange and asking the question, you know, for whom is the job or the proper job an aspiration? For whom is it not? You know, for whom is it a norm, and for whom has it never been, in fact, normal? For whom is it aspirational? If not through paid work or proper jobs or any kinds of jobs, how else do people make a living? You know, through practices of exchange, through other modes of distribution. You know, it's striking actually how impoverished our vocabulary is for thinking about modes of livelihood outside the proper job. a vacuum of vocabulary for understanding all the different ways that people, in fact, survive and make a living in ways which do not center on or revolve around paid work. So, you know, there's an empirical, there's a conceptual challenge, there's a kind of an empirical challenge. And, you know, there's also the mystery, you know, of how we became so addicted to the idea of work as kind of, you know, arbiter of personal value and worth and entitlement and so on. So, you know, the empirical questions that could be usefully asked, you know, probably in every part of the world, you know, in Brazil, where you are now, Gabrielle, right? In Canada, where I work, I mean, many young people are very aware that they are not, of my students, that they are not going to be able to replicate the class position of their parents, that they will not have, quote, proper jobs in their lifetime, that they probably won't own a house or a car, you know, there's, and yet they too create meaning in their lives and, you know, make, earn their livelihood or survive in many different ways. And so, you know, there's a whole sort of empirical field that opens up for investigation when you decenter both paid work and the idea of work from the center of your analysis.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And Tanya, everything we've been discussing is intersected by politics in the end, which you've called the underlying puzzle in your work. And one of the things you do is to offer an ethnographic approach to politics, one that draws perhaps from Gramsci, as sometimes you mention, or Stuart Hall, that makes of politics an arena of inquiry, almost as politics as a practice. And here, you've said before that critique is a means of discovering in a configuration of power its inherent possibility of being other than it is. How do you define politics in your work? And I think it touches in everything we're talking about today.
Thank you. So I think this idea of critique and politics, they're very closely linked for me, perhaps they're even identical in the sense that, and thank you for sort of recognizing the emphasis that I place on politics as a practice, you know, rather than a thing. So what then is the practice of politics? Mm-hmm. For me, it is... it's a practice or an embodied stance of refusal, of stubbornness, of separation. Initially, perhaps, incoherent but visceral sense that something is not right with the world. Word critique, I read, means actually separation, like to separate yourself from something happening in the world is to be not at one with it, right? To step back however minutely and to feel that there's a problem here. So that's kind of the first part of the practice of politics for me would be taking that critical distance. And the second part, that's where I really draw on Stuart Hall, who articulated this or who expressed this very well with his concept of articulation. And, you know, what he pointed to is the sort of the double move. On the one hand, to articulate is to name something and make explicit. Mm-hmm. So it's taking that embodied sense of difference or unease or critique or that feeling that something is not right, and naming it, you know, making it explicit. And then the second part of articulation for him is connection, right? Connecting up with others, sharing your unease, creating an analysis out of it, and then figuring out, you know, what you're going to do about it. So those are all parts of the practice of politics. And what Hall was trying to understand in his writing, you know, I grew up in England and in the, and I was a teenager in the 1970s, I was a university student in the 1980s, you know, Thatcher's period. And that's what Hall was trying to make sense of. He was trying to understand the popular appeal of Thatcherism. Why was it that working class people in Britain, who one might think of, you know, their class interest, did not lie with Thatcher, nevertheless found her analysis and her way of naming things and connecting their unease to a certain diagnosis and a certain kind of prescription utterly persuasive, you know, hence they voted for her repeatedly, you know, in numerous elections. So how do you make sense of that, right? How do you analyze what it is that makes someone uneasy, how they name it, and how that naming connects that sense of unease to a certain kind of set of social forces and ultimately to a political program? So, you know, in my ethnographic work, I'm always asking this question: what is it that bothers people? Like, you know, what is it that bothered the Highlanders in my book Land's End? What is it that bothers people who've been occupied by a plantation corporation? Like, what is it that makes them feel uneasy? How do they name it? Where do they go with that thought? Who do they talk to? You know, what do they think can be done about it? All of those sorts of questions are, for me, you know, the practice of politics understood as a set of kind of affects, actions, and practices that one can, in fact, examine ethnographically, and that we should examine ethnographically, which make any sense of the world around us.
Yes. And just picking up on some of the words you mentioned, this emphasis on the value of critique, disagreement, different separation, you mentioned this conflict, it offers a counterposition to the idea that we are now here all the time, that we're living post-political times, where political questions are reframed as just as matters of expertise. And this is what you started touching on in the beginning of the conversation, that in the end closes down the debate on how and what to govern. And it also empties out social struggles from the agenda of understanding power imbalances. And so being political, as you also mentioned, is obviously different from practicing party politics. And in fact, it challenges the uncritical acceptance of a common sense. And I know that you've written about Gramsci and talking and the way he talks or describes the common sense being something deeply incoherent in the end, which has the potential to induce moral and political passivity. So do you think the direction we are going is one of a flight from politics and an ever-increasing adherence to this kind of fabricated common sense? Or the opposite, more of an engagement with? I know it's a completely abstract question in the sense that how can we know, but there are some currents based, and how do you read these currents based on your experience?
Yes, I think, you know, as you've already sort of intimated, I don't know that I have thoughts on the grand direction. In fact, when I wrote that piece you're referring to on that I called kind of Politics Interrupted, It was probably a decade ago, and I would say that we are this argument about the post-politics and the dominance of expertise is harder to sustain today. I think, you know, we're in a period of mass skepticism about expertise. You know, we've seen it throughout the COVID pandemic, you know, everyone feeling competent to question the expert advice of public health authorities and, you know, thinking that they know better how to manage this pandemic and so on. So I think it's hard to say we are in a period of kind of rule of experts, you know, to quote the title of Tim Mitchell's book. But the experts are still there and they're part of the picture. Are we And there's certainly many things that make people uneasy and that they criticize, right? I think what we are probably, you know, and it would be hard to say that it's all fragmented, right? Because some of this does, in fact, congeal into movements. You know, we're witnessing this looking, you know, from Canada at our southern neighbor and the enormous persuasiveness of Donald Trump. I mean, it's many people are able to identify their unease with the way the world is going, you know, with a political program that is being enunciated for them and to which they attach themselves very vigorously. Just as for other people, you know, this is just a load of nonsense and it makes does not capture their hearts or minds at all. So I think it's very hard to say, to come down on any view of this. Post-political, not really, rule of experts, frayed but still present, you know, absence of mobilization, not really. You know, people all over the world are deeply mobilized. And I think, you know, even the world, the role of organized religion, you know, is something that, you know, modernization theorists a century ago, you know, imagining, you know, the direction of history, sort of imagined an unenchanted world in which organized religions would become less and less persuasive. But we, you know, we're living in a period of strong evangelisms, you know, whether it's Hinduism, even Buddhism in Burma, you know, not supposed to be a proselytizing religion, but, you know, there they are. And Islam, Christianity, it's like people are very attached to sets of ideas which seem to offer for them explanations of what's wrong with the world and how to fix it. So I it would be hard to say there's a flight from politics. There's just its articulation, you know, in different forms, in different idioms, you know, around different kinds of unease, different prognoses, different prescriptions. Yeah, I don't see a sort of an absence of politics. I see there's plenty of it. Not all of it going in directions that I find very
exactly.
It's not that people are passive. I mean, you know, you've just been through an election in Brazil, right, where the population was massively mobilized around two very polarizing figures, and so, you know, yeah, a lot going on actually with politics.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I guess, you know, what it comes down to is, you know, we do need vocabulary or sort of an analytical vocabulary to enable us to approach this. And it has to be one that's nimble enough to capture practices and expressions of politics, which aren't just limited to the question of parties, but, you know, pervade the everyday.
Yes. Yeah. So to close down our conversation, I would like to continue discussing the present condition, but looking more towards the future, because all these processes that we've discussed of land enclosure, exclusion of populations, extraction of many sorts from nature, profit maximization, and perhaps political engagement or disengagement, they sometimes may paint a grim future. And you've argued that we need a different framework for understanding and responding to the predicament of hundreds of millions of people whose current and future livelihood will be left out of account, and that we have to start by seriously identifying these what you call blocked paths or dead ends that go sometimes unnoticed and come in tandem with the systems we've set in place. In the case of the Highlanders you've studied, you said that they urgently need support through the distribution of land or access to jobs or effective state-based transfer schemes. In Indonesia, but I think we can say everywhere, a commitment to distribution, you've proposed it should be fought on political grounds. So do you believe we're likely to see more redistributive or redistribution practices that can reach the majority of the world who's being left out? Or which kind of future your ethnographic experience permits you to envision?
Yes, well, I'm in general, I mean, it's hard to be optimistic, right, given the world as we find it. And I think how does one retain any shred of, if not optimism, then, a sense that things could be different than how they are. I mean, one way I usually think about this is by thinking about when something that I consider progressive happens, and such things do happen. It's like, how does it happen? No, how did it happen? What are the conditions of possibility that have set something new in place? And something new has emerged in history, which wasn't there before, and that I considered to be, worth having. So, one could think of an example, as an example I sometimes use in my teaching, but, think of gay rights, for example, in the last four decades, probably, there's been a massive transformation, not everywhere in the world, but in large parts of the world, towards acceptance of, people and practices which, through much of history, have been regarded as or treated as illegal and treated as elements of shame and so on. Like, this has changed. It's changed in my lifetime, and it's changed in a way which I consider to be very progressive. How did that happen? What was necessary to put that set of changes in place? You'd have to think, the massive role of the cultural industries, movies, artistic work, novels, there are, many things were part of that cultural shift, which was then kind of eventually and slowly consolidated by political and legal shift, always still under attack, always still precarious, but, something happened there. Think of another example, in your own country, think about, a period, Lula's period in Brazil, during that period, redistributive programs, affirmative action in the university, a lot of racialized students in Brazil that, had access to higher education, even to university for the first time. Like, something progressive happened there, for a period, right? Then it got rolled back, and now it might even reemerge. So I think, always asking, what were the conditions of possibility that enabled that to happen? And how can those conditions be expanded or replicated or, valued, respected, honored even, right? I mean, that kind of analysis is helpful when one might otherwise very easily succumb to despair. Like, good things do happen, but we need to understand why and how, what was necessary to put those conditions in place. I think that's really all I can think of. I guess, for me, I mean, maybe just to end up with this, going back to the question of politics, I think, so long as people everywhere do in fact retain a critical sensibility, right? That the world as we have it is not acceptable, right? There is something wrong with this picture. And, I think this, you think this, a great many people, if not everyone actually, is aware that this just is not the best we can do, and so what happens with that thought, how it gets articulated, who connects to that thought, what happens to it at different scales. I mean, those are all the kind of, the empirical questions, but we're not zombies. Like, we don't actually just accept all of this as normal. It's not normal. I'm convinced of that, and I think most people are as well.
Yeah. No, thank you, Tania. Thank you for all this generosity and and for making the time to talk to me. This was amazing. I just would like to thank you again.